Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd, Kenter, Thomas & Parrish, LLC, and Boilermakers Local 83. Since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand for working families against those who would do harm, and that's Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish. And this show is sponsored by the proud union Boilermakers Local 83 from the Kansas City, Missouri office and Iowa, Nebraska, and Kansas. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI both thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we talk to two authors. First, what are choke points and how can logistics workers use them to build global worker power? We'll find out from Choke Points co-author Jake Alamahomed Wilson. Then, here's Cindy Faisal, wife of NFLer Grant Faisal. She will describe how playing professional football contributed to his death. She'll talk about her book, After the Cheering Stops. In the news, wow, the Supreme Court sure doesn't want to deal with gerrymandering. And from Parkland to KCK, students rally on the gun issue. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. This week, she'll explain what Trump and company get wrong about immigration law. Now for the news. The news from our side, June 21st, 2018. The U.S. Supreme Court has once again dodged the issue of whether a partisan gerrymandering of state legislative districts and the U.S. House violates voters' constitutional rights. PAI reports that in a case challenging the heavily Republican and heavily gerrymandered Wisconsin legislature, the justices punted. They said the 12 Democratic voters from Madison and elsewhere who challenged the state assembly districts must prove harm to themselves. General harm to their rights to fair representation or fair consideration of their views in the legislature doesn't qualify. Chief Justice John Roberts said in a 9-0 ruling, the justices also applied the same rule to a Maryland case involving the state's gerrymandered 6th congressional district drawn by Democrats. The court didn't close the door on all partisan gerrymandering suits. Instead, it told the Wisconsin group that they'd have to go back to lower courts and show the gerrymandering hurts them individually. So how hard is that? Well, let's take Missouri as an example. Maybe if the Clean Amendment, which will be on the November ballot in Missouri and which would end gerrymandering in this state, doesn't pass, we could make the challenge Or we could take a McDonald's worker from Kansas City or St. Louis, a construction worker from Trenton, and a home health worker from anywhere, let alone a Missouri public employee. We could throw in a few dreamers forced to pay international tuition rates at public universities and some school children whose school budgets were cut. What they all could show is real damage to their lives by the extremely gerrymandered Missouri legislature. Nationwide, citizens of North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania, as well as Wisconsin, will probably be showing harm caused by gerrymandering in upcoming court cases because all of their legislatures have pushed through anti-worker, anti-democratic legislation.
Over 1,500 area residents, students, and activists came to the Reardon Convention Center in Kansas City, Kansas, to hear students discuss and advocate for gun control. The public forum was part of a national tour by the March for Our Lives movement. With only 4 days' notice, the organizers had to open another room to hold the attendees. A town hall format was in place as the student moderators posed questions to the panelists. Panelists were included Chicago students, Doman Douglas students, St. Louis students, and metro area high school students. Applause was thunderous at various points during the assembly. Panelists spoke out definitively about age not being a barrier to make social change, as well as the message of vote them out if candidates receive money from the NRA. When asked about demands for the movement, Cameron from Stoneman Douglas High School enumerated the following.
I think we need an expansion of universal background checks in private sales. I think that anybody who is a lawful gun owner should be all about private sales having background checks, because if you are a law-abiding citizen purchasing a weapon, you should be perfectly willing to go through a background check. There are several states in this country where domestic abusers are allowed to buy weapons, and yet many of these gun crimes you'll see are from people who have been domestic abusers before. That is something we can change, and again, if you are a law-abiding citizen, there's no problem with that on your end. Another thing that I think a lot of people can look into is the funding of CDC research into gun violence, but there's no funding yet. We need to make sure the CDC gets funding, because in recent history, 80% of the gun deaths you'll see in the world have been in the United States. That's a health epidemic. Another few more things we can look into are the digitalization of ATF files. There are many states in which weapons from crime scenes cannot be traced back to the owner with anything but a paper trail. There have been several cities where the digitalization of ATF files have proven to trace guns back to their owners that have been used in crimes more efficiently, and I see no reason for this not to be implemented everywhere. On our website, marchforlives.com, there are 10 policy points, like the ones I just mentioned, that will actively save lives and have actively saved lives if you look at the statistics in those states where they have been implemented.
The White House announced today that it plans to try to merge the Departments of Education and Labor. No, this is not a story from The Onion, although most teachers and union members probably hope it is. NPR reported that they want to call the new concoction the Department Education and the Workforce. The proposal was part of a 132-page document outlining a broad restructuring of the federal government assembled by Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. Yeah, that's the same guy trying to destroy the Consumer Finance Financial Protection Bureau. Of course, it's all being done in the name of efficiency. It also reflects the administration's conflation of education and career skills as if they're the same thing. The consolidation would create, within the new department, four sub-agencies, including one called the American Workforce and Higher Education Administration. Other sub-agencies include one devoted to K-12 education, one for research, evaluation, and administration, and one for enforcement. The latter would enforce both worker protections and civil rights laws that protect the nation's students. Representative Virginia Fox, a North Carolina Republican and the chairman of the House Committee on Education and the Workforce, said, "The federal government is long overdue for a serious overhaul." On the other hand, minority chair of the same committee, Representative Bobby Scott, Democrat of Virginia, said that the Department of Labor is no more equipped to oversee elementary education policy then the Department of Education is prepared to enforce the standards for coal mine safety. The logic behind this proposal is painfully thin. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, Chris Mann, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Hi, Hi, this is Kim Claus. In the past several decades, manufacturing and distributing has gone from a Fordist model to a global capitalist logistics model. During this same time, we've seen a decline in worker power and struggles in organizing. But the structure of the logistics model also has places where workers could bring the whole thing to a grinding halt in order to build power. Dr. Jake Ali Muhammad Wilson and Emmanuel Ness co-edited a book called Choke Points, Logistics Workers Disrupting the Global Supply Chain. I recently had a chance to talk to Dr. Jake Ali Muhammad Wilson about this work. Jake Ali Muhammad Wilson, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you, Kim. Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So before we get to the meat of your book, Choke Points, I want to talk a little about the process of putting it together. How did this particular book come about, and how did you gather so many incredible writers from around the world to contribute to it?
Sure. So, for many years, I've been studying logistics and logistics workers. These are the workers that move the goods around the world, in and out of our ports and warehouses. Emmanuel Ness, who's my co-editor, has, been a leading, social justice-driven scholar in the field of critical labor studies. And so a couple of years ago, a mutual friend of ours introduced us, and both Manny and I immediately started talking about editing a book on logistics workers' struggles. And we wanted it to be global in scope. And so, we kind of had a few phone conversations. Manny teaches at Brooklyn College. I teach at California State University in Long Beach. So we had we're on opposite coasts.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was actually a strength because it allowed us to tap our various networks. Manny has a vast, kind of global network of labor organizers and scholars. That just came together, and everyone pretty much who we asked, who was either an organizer or kind of a leftist scholar, was very excited about the project. And so we were very pleased with the number of participants that gave the book a really global scope, not just focusing on U.S. struggles facing logistics workers, but workers all around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I found it, the whole thing, very fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about logistics workers themselves. Who are they?
Sure. So, I think I'll start with, I live in Long Beach, California, which is the South Los Angeles county, and it's a port city. And so that's how I started, really looking at logistics. And so I think I'll use Los Angeles as an example. So in Southern California, there's two ports. There's the Port of Long Beach and Port of Los Angeles. And the workers connected to the ports are generally logistics workers. So the Port of LA and Long Beach, they employ longshore workers, dock workers. These are the workers that unload the goods. But before the goods get here, the goods have to be brought via cargo ship. And those are another group of logistics workers called seafarers. And they are probably one of the most invisibilized workers in the logistics industry. Seafarers, most of them come from the Philippines or China or India. And they oftentimes spend 9 months at sea. Another key group of workers are the port truckers or long-haul truckers, the truck drivers. And they move the goods to either warehouse or distribution center, where another group of workers in warehouse and distribution centers unpack and repack the goods before they are either sent to a store or via e-commerce to someone's front door. And we can't forget also railroad workers. They are another important group of transportation workers that move the goods all across the country, in the United States especially.
Yeah, so of course, in my mind, when you order something from Amazon, it magically appears at the doorstep. So,
right.
I mean, there are so many steps that happen between, between there and here and for all of our goods. So the choke points themselves, can you describe those for us and tell us what makes them so important in organizing?
Absolutely. So what we've seen over the past 25 to 30 years, we've seen a revolution in the way in which goods are produced and transported. So gone are the days where goods are produced and sit in the warehouse, for weeks on end. Today, goods move in and out, and we call it the just-in-time economy, where retailers and are pressuring suppliers to cut costs and to speed things up and to be more efficient. And so what has created is kind of a rearrangement of, you know, class relations in regard to the global economy. So the supply chain is very global in scope today. And so the magic behind, you know, ordering goods on Amazon and they arrive at someone's front door in 2 days means that the workers that move those goods are facing extraordinary changes in the workplace. So whether it's an Amazon warehouse where workers are facing management by stress practices, union busting, here in the Empire, about 30 miles from the Port of Los Angeles, the largest warehouse complex in the world, you have a large number of the workers there employed by third-party staffing agencies, which has created a host of, you know, problems for workers' safety, for having jobs that pay, you know, middle-class wages. So all around the world, what, you know, Manny and I discovered is that the workers are struggling in the logistics sectors all around the world. Mm-hmm. And there's some similarities that we've found. And I think that's one of the strengths of choke points. So getting to your question, mm-hmm. Choke points are, I think of it in a bottleneck of sorts, where goods, a large number of goods have to go through limited geographic space. So whether that's a port, here in Los Angeles, 40% of all goods entering the United States enter through the Port of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and they're basically neighboring ports. You don't see the difference. It's a, you know, invisible lines, you know, dividing these ports. 40% of all goods entering the U.S. come through these ports in L.A. That's a tremendous amount of trade. So that's a choke point. So if those workers are organized, that can have a tremendous effect, an impact, in strengthening unions, raising working standards and pay and safety regulations. So focusing on choke points, again, these bottlenecks in the economy, in today's just-in-time economy, is a very important strategic move for labor.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a different way to look at organizing, right? So it's more about organizing, yes, along these supply chains instead of looking more at job classification.
Exactly. So, you know, I recall about 15 or 20 years ago, there was a lot of talk in the media about Walmart, and its impact on Main Street USA, which is all true. Mm-hmm. You know, you've seen, you know, bookstores got out of business and sporting goods stores and toy stores and all these businesses on the retail side certainly were impacted by this massive, the largest corporation in the world, Walmart. But what we found was it's not just the retail side, which gets a lot of the attention. It's the workers that move the goods that are often kind of invisible from the public eye that have had detrimental impacts. We've had a decline in unionization in the warehouse sector due to third-party staffing agencies that exploit a large number here in Southern California of immigrant workers, workers of color around the United States. And we see the same kind of forces going on, whether it's in Northern Italy or it's outside of Paris or in Poland, in Germany, all around the world. These case studies that are featured in this book, Choke Points, we see some commonalities there where workers are being squeezed globally. And so I think a renewed energy and focus of looking at logistics and the ways in which goods are moved and transported, and logistics workers in particular, has been something that offers
in some ways, hope for a beleaguered labor movement.
Yeah. So speaking of the warehouse workers, you know, you're right. We've really become aware of them. You know, a lot of people in labor circles have in the last several years, and the way they're hired and employed seems to present a whole list of problems. But there really have been some pretty strong attempts at organizing them. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Absolutely. So we see a lot of really inspiring workers' actions. Here in Southern California, where I live, the Warehouse Workers Resource Center, which is a nonprofit organization that works with improving working conditions and challenging things, workplace safety hazards and low pay for largely immigrant workers here in the Inland Empire. Again, it's the largest warehouse sector in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Has had some tremendous gains. I think one in particular that stands out was the workers who are toiling in the very hot, windowless warehouses in the Inland Empire. Again, it's about 30 miles east of Los Angeles. Won a class action suit against Walmart. You know, Walmart was, is a leader in employing third-party contingent kind of staffing agencies for wage theft. There's a lot of wage theft where workers are not being paid their proper overtime in the warehouse sector. So there was a large class action suit which benefited the workers, and hundreds and hundreds of workers were paid the wages that they were due. There was a really interesting action called the Wall March, where they marched on the warehouse there. In the Midwest, in Chicago is a thriving organizing situation going on, and the Warehouse Workers for Justice in Chicago are challenging the rise in third party staffing, whether it's in Amazon, and I think a key thing to understand is that these jobs used to be pretty decent jobs. Mm-hmm. They were solidly lower middle class, working class jobs. There was overtime, there was vacation and sick leave, and sometimes benefits. And these have all been eroded due to this change in kind of global logistics. So there's, a really important site to organize. And I think Chicago and Los Angeles, and also globally, there's some really interesting things going on. One chapter in the book that is one of my favorite chapters was written by a group of Amazon workers themselves. And there are a group of Amazon workers in a warehouse in Poznan, Poland. And it was a group of workers that, their names are not signed individually. They wanted to be just Amazon workers and their supporters is the name that they were credited. But it's about their attempts to unionize this Amazon warehouse in Poland and the tactics that management has used to divide them. But kind of outlines the challenges of their struggle. And I found the chapter to be really inspiring, actually.
Absolutely, me too. Okay, so these stories are so, they're really wonderful stories. And one of the things I really liked about them is that even though as I'm reading through and reading about actions and struggles, my heart gets broken a little bit because, some of them are not as successful as they would have liked. But it's kind of like a lot of labor struggles that have always happened. It's sometimes you don't get what you wanted, but they make gains in education and worker power. There's so many lessons, I think, to be learned. So can you tell me what you think the biggest lesson to be learned from this book is?
Yeah, I think the last couple of chapters of the book, are not written by academics. They're written by labor organizers.
Mm-hmm.
And both the last couple of chapters, one written by Sheriar Kuzji from the Warehouse Workers Resource Center, and the other by Peter Olney, who's the former organizing director of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, both kind of reflect on the last 15, 20 years of struggle as labor leaders. And both of them have some really important insights. I think One is, you know, one takeaway is that we have to listen to workers, you know, and so thinking about how unions organize and increase worker power, have to find out, you know, what do the workers want? And I think looking at the legal structure is another important thing. Where are there areas in the legal structure that workers can use to their advantage? What are the challenges? And how can we think globally about struggles, right? So if all these goods are coming into the United States as imports, how is a warehouse worker in Chicago or Los Angeles connected to a seafarer or a factory worker in Shenzhen?
Yes.
Or a port worker in South Africa or Latin America? Thinking, because, you know, corporations think very globally. So I think another takeaway is that unions need to think globally as well as locally, that globalization is a process that should also influence the ways in which workers are organized. And so I think, you know, the takeaway, you know, for a lot of the stories, not all of them ended, you know, with a clear-cut victory, but sometimes even losses can inform future struggles and strategies.
Okay, so is there, we have just about 2 minutes left. Can you tell me, is there anything else you'd like us to know that we haven't covered?
Yes, I would like to, any listener that is interested in purchasing the book Choke Points, it's on Pluto Press, and if you are a listener to this program, I would like to share a discount code for the Pluto website that will get your listeners 30% off the book. If you put in the discount code CHOKE, CHOKE, on the Pluto Books website, you will get 30% off just for supporting this radio program. I want to thank you, Kim, and everyone at the program who made this possible. And if anyone has any, would like to contact me directly, just share their thoughts on the book, my email address is jake.wilson@cslb.edu. I'd be happy to speak with any of your listeners. I'm sure my colleague Manny Ness would as well. And I think just to kind of highlight, there's folk, the book has chapters on Palestinian truck drivers, on Chinese port workers, on the ports all around the world from South Africa. They're looking at anti-racist struggles and the key role that South African unionists on the docks have organized, Latin American port transformations and neoliberalism in Turkey. It's very global. So I would be very humbled if any of your audience would be interested in picking the book up. Again, it's CHOKE in all capitals for the discount.
Thank you so much. Well, and that is it for us. I can't believe we're already out of time. So Dr. Jake Ali Muhammad Wilson, thank you so much for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Jake Ali Muhammad Wilson's research explores the way in which racism and labor exploitation intersect. He is particularly interested in the role of logistics in the global economy and the key role that logistics workers play in resisting capitalist exploitation across the global supply chain. He has written two other books and countless articles and is a professor at California State University at Long Beach.
KKFI is throwing a party June 30th at the Folly Theater, and you're invited. Two all-star bands backing over 20 great artists reflecting the diversity of our community. Doors at 7, shows at 8, tickets beginning at just $15. More info at kkfi.org/events.
Hi, this is Bill Sundahl with KKFI. Thanks so much to Meshuggah Bagels for sustaining our volunteers during this last fund drive. We appreciate it a lot when a family-owned business supports KKFI. For the last 3 years, Meshuggah has been supporting KKFI, and we want to thank all the staff and the Lindy family for keeping your community radio volunteers fed. Thanks, and we look forward to a long partnership.
Rediscovering Harvey Milk on This Way Out, Saturday at 2, right after the 10th Voice.
This week on the Thursday night special at 7:30, Shots in the Night presents the ultimate stinging sci-fi classic, Dobber. If you hear them, it's already too late. That's Dobber on the Thursday night special at 7:30. Look out and wear your repellent.
Welcome to the second half of the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm glad to be hosting this program. The famous song Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin that you just heard a minute ago happens to be one of Grant and Cindy Feisel's favorite songs. Grant was an NFL player who died at a young age from injuries caused by concussions he received while playing football for the NFL. We are so lucky to have his wife, Cindy, with us tonight. Cindy has written a book entitled After the Cheering Stops. Welcome, Cindy.
Hi, thank you so much. And I just want to say that the last name is Feisel. That's okay. It gets mispronunciated a lot. So it's Feisel, like easel, only with an F in front of it. So
well, great. And your background as a teacher, you want that to be correct, like all teachers. That's really good.
I know. All my little students call me by all sorts of different pronunciations, so it's just funny. So anyway, well, it's Feisel, and the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and I'm able to order it online from Target and Walmart. So I'd say Amazon's the surefire place to get it, though.
Okay, great. I was going to ask you that at the very end, but I will ask you that again. The Heartland Labor Forum wants to express our deepest sympathy for the loss of your husband and all that you have suffered from that. Grant's injuries were from concussions, but he had turned to alcohol to cope with the pain and the misery of all the what was happening to his brain. And I wanted to start off by asking you to give our listeners a short summary of the book, After the Cheering Stops. And why fundamentally did you write the book?
Okay, well, I just learned more and more about CTE once Grant died. I didn't really know anything about it. I had heard that other professional athletes were dying and that the autopsy reports were coming back that they had it, like Mike Webster, who played for the Steelers for years, Dave Durison, who played for the Bears, Junior Seau. All of these had died prior to Grant, and I didn't really understand it, but I knew that it had something to do with the hits in football, and so did Grant. Grant actually died not really knowing what CTE was. It was just starting to be talked about 6 years ago when he died. So once I got the autopsy report back and it said he had stage 3, when I thought about all the different events that had happened in our lifetime and all of the stories that I had written in a journal, I realized that it coincided with the symptoms of CTE, and I just wondered if there was anybody out there that had had a life like Grant and I had had together. I thought that maybe somehow my book could reach some other women, and it certainly did. I just wanted people to understand that CTE is a real disease, and it's scary, and it's preventable. People don't understand that, but it's preventable. I wanted people to understand that it was a sport-related degenerative brain disease I don't think people understand CTE is degenerative. I wanted kids and athletes on all levels to understand that it was real. Administrators, parents, coaches, I wanted all of them to understand that they could take active steps to prevent it. I felt like that Grant would really want me to talk about this to others, especially since I'm an educator.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really like about your book, I'd like you to tell our listeners what you trace very clearly in the book, what type of husband, father, and person was Grant was before playing professional football, and then describe some of the changes you saw after he late in his career and then after he retired.
Okay, I just want to start off by saying that Grant was a super smart person. I considered him to be a Renaissance man. He knew a little bit about everything, music and poetry, and he was not only a great, outstanding football player when we married, but he was smart, and that's what made him set him apart different than a lot of the other athletes that I knew. A lot of them didn't have options. Grant was accepted into all the major medical schools and dental schools in the state of Texas. So he had a lot of other things that he could have done. But he went on to play football. He played 117 games over the course of 10 years. And slowly but surely, I started noticing changes in his behavior. I say it's like the sands on a seashore, you know, just slowly eroding away. He started bringing in alcohol into our home, and we hadn't had any prior, you know, that we kept in the house. And not only would he, which that wasn't unusual, but just bringing it in and drinking all of it and then taking it out to the dumpster and throwing it out. It was just odd behavior. He started coming in with little bags of pills that were unidentified. And as I always say, back in the 80s, you know, we didn't have pill finder ID like we do now on the internet. So it was really difficult for me to understand what these pills were. They looked like aspirin, perhaps then, or Tylenol. And he would say it was just something that the trainer had given him, or the doctor had given him to just ease the pain. He was having trouble sleeping. By this time, he'd probably played 8 years. He had a serious staph infection during that time that I thought would have ended his career and could have easily, but he continued to play. And, of course, you know, people forget on Sunday when they see these football players and all the big hits and all that it's real people. It's not a video game. And so there's real people who are taking the hits. And over a period of time, it just really wears the body down.
And also one of the things you noticed that I read in your book about the demands of the players, the work schedule, striving to please the coaches, players can lose their spot on the team.
Oh, yeah. If you complain about anything and have to stay out for a game, you have to fight for that position all over again, usually, because, you know, you can be replaced real easy in the NFL, unless you're a superstar. And Grant was definitely, you know, one of those players that he was steady, but he wasn't a number one draft pick. He wasn't somebody that could have been easily replaced. So he always worried about that.
Mm-hmm. And did you and the other wives of the NFL players ever have conversations about injuries and pain that the players were suffering? Did you ever share that?
We did. We talked about that. We said, you know, it was rough on our men and that they complained a lot about everything from back aches to knee aches to many of them were, you know, had surgery during the year. A lot of them were put on IR, it's called, injured reserve. And so we did have those conversations. But I tell you what we never talked about. We never, ever, ever talked about a concussion, or we never talked about the fact that repetitive head hits over and over in practice and in games would cause any kind of danger to the brain. We never discussed that.
So, and do you believe that the National Football League has been forthcoming in their knowledge about the effects of concussions? Has the National Football League acknowledged that they even have a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think all of this kneeling and the flag things, I think that's all just deflection upon the real problem at hand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what other company could you work for and have people dying and your employees dying of a brain disease and it not be a full investigation? It's not really talked about that much. They said that they revved up the concussion protocol, which maybe they did, but there's a lot of people that are dead and dying that didn't get the benefits of that, and I'm not sure that that's a real, you know, a real deal. I think they say they do a lot of looking, but as you and I both know, we saw examples last year of several different players that continued to play anyway.
Have you known anybody to receive any compensation for injuries?
Not yet.
Okay.
No. And I say it every day, loud and long, that the NFL is only concerned about the money. I don't think they're concerned about a player. And I say this, it doesn't matter what your name is. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you're a first-round draft pick, if you're a walk-on, if you were a fourth-round, fifth-round draft pick. It doesn't matter. Their main concern is the games being played and the money that is made. And you and I both know that there's millions and millions and millions of money in the NFL.
Yeah, and how long do you believe the NFL has known about damage from concussions?
I think that since the early 1900s, I really do. I think they've known since Roosevelt was a president that that football could cause problems with the brain. He even called a special summit when he was the president to talk about it. I just know that it's been a huge cover-up for a long time. But, you know, we've heard about these things before, coal miners, you know, tobacco, anything that's a big moneymaker in the United States seems like has corruption in it.
And how do you think the brutality in football and other sports such as hockey, rugby, soccer has gotten this far? Why is brutality considered a sport?
I don't understand it. I wish it wasn't. I had no idea. I guess we didn't ask the right questions. Grant was going to be a doctor. He was a pre-med major, and he never learned while he was in college that the brain was soft like Jell-O. Well, we know now that it is, and we also know that a lot of people that play head-banging sports get ALS, they get Alzheimer's, they get Parkinson's and dementia. And the final autopsy can show that they have CTE because all of those diseases mimic what CTE is. I didn't understand that when Grant was having these problems, he had short-term memory loss. He had trouble focusing on anything. He ran out of energy a lot. He would say he was tired. I couldn't understand why. He couldn't process things as fast as he had before. All of these things started happening. He got depressed. He even got on antidepressants. He got on anti-anxiety drugs because he got anxiety. I didn't realize that all of those things were red flags for a traumatic brain injury. We've never, ever talked about it. We've never heard about it. Now we understand that all of those symptoms have something to do with the brain injury that these players receive.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you comment quite a bit on the amount of drugs the players are given, even mm-hmm. just to suit up.
Yes, and I say that the NFL got Grant hooked on drugs. And if you Google that, you can see that many of the players have talked about over the years getting hooked on opiates. And so I say that Grant was hooked on drugs while he was in the NFL, and then when he retired, what was he supposed to do? They weren't going to give him a prescription for Percocet and Vicodin for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. So he started drinking.
Yes.
And I believe that the NFL drove the addiction in his life, and, you know, it's very upsetting to me. It mm-hmm. really is. And the amount of people that play, even in college, and you think about the ones that start when they're so young. Grant started playing football when he was 8 years old. He played from 8 to 32. So I think he was brain damaged for a long time.
So what has to change in the game of football in order to make it more humane?
Well, I don't know that anything can change to make it more humane. I do think that what will happen over the course of the years, it'll become more of a gladiator sport. And perhaps the only people that will be playing will be ones that say, well, what would my life be like if I didn't play? I don't have any other options. Grant had options, again, and there's a lot of men that have played in the NFL over the years that had options. They were smart. They could have done a lot of other things. But I think that in the future it'll become, because we're going to find out so much more about the brain injury and it's going to be talked about more and more and more, the NFL is going to have to face the facts that it's just going to be people that feel like they can't do anything else.
So what have you learned since you've written the book and you've started this process of telling the truth against a very powerful corporation, the NFL?
Well, yes, I've learned that you can't fight money and power. All I can do is just continue to say things out loud, like on your program, and hope that somebody else will listen and tell someone else. So it becomes like the gossip game where two people tell two more people. I consider every time I get an opportunity to speak on the radio or out loud in any kind of forum, I consider it a real opportunity to tell the truth. I say I'll never stop. I don't plan on ever stopping. I have a Facebook page. It's Cindy Feasel. It's Cindy Feasel, and I talk about it every single day. And it is in the news nearly every single day. There's someone somewhere talking about brain injury in sports and CTE. I'm also, just trying to convince parents to please look at the evidence before you put your child in a head-banging sport, whether it be football or heading in soccer or hockey. Please look at the dangers to the brain. I know that football is, the most popular, and people do think that football is a great sport to put your child in to learn, lifetime. I'm just not even sure of what they think. I just think that they think it's a good thing to be a part of a team, and I think it is, but I think that you can be a part of a baseball team, a basketball team. You can swim. They can be in track. There's so many other things that the children can be in and it not damage their brain.
So I take it you're not very optimistic about the National Football League doing the right thing and correcting all this. I share your sentiments on this. It looks like money and power are,
yes,
corporate power are abusing the players and taking people's money. So
yes, and even when you buy merchandise, people don't understand this, but when you go buy a T-shirt from your favorite team, guess who gets the money?
Yes, the National Football League.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay, so how can our listeners get your book? You mentioned at the beginning of the program Amazon was the best way to do that. And how can they get in touch with you?
Oh, great. I would love that. Well, Amazon, I think, is the best way because I say it comes straight to your door. A lot of Barnes & Nobles around do carry the book, but many times people have said in other states, other than Texas, that they've had to order it from Barnes & Noble. But I know on barnesandnoble.com you can get it, target.com, walmart.com. But I just always say that Amazon is just, a great place that always has it, and it can come straight to your door. I ask, too, that people please, once you read it, I would love for you to rate it on Amazon, because that's really important. Just like if you were to go buy a pair of tennis shoes and you would like to talk about how great they are or what you did or didn't like, it's just helpful. And so I asked that, kindly, if you would please do that, that would be great. And I'm on Facebook. I do answer anybody that has questions. I try to within 24 hours. I have a website, Cindy Feasel at Cindy Feasel. I just ask that you get in touch with me, because I know there are a lot of people out there that all of a sudden the light might come on and it might click with you. Hey, my loved one is having some problems, and I know that they've played a sport where possibilities that CTE could be a problem. So I do connect with people all the time, and usually once or twice a week I'm contacted by a wife of a player, and so I do feel that I did the right thing by writing the book and by telling the truth. And so I'm just happy to be a resource, and I ask anybody to reach out to me.
Well, Cindy, we are out of time. I have to say, through this book, you have spoken truth to power. More people need to hear your account of the events that resulted in Grant's death. We wish nothing but the best for you and your family. Thank you for having the courage to speak for Grant and the hundreds of other players who are denied benefits medical help and suffer from unnecessary brutality in football. Thank you for coming on this show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it so much.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I wanted to talk about a little bit about something that's been in the news a lot lately, and that's family separation, the executive order that the president signed yesterday, and family detention. The president has been talking and tweeting and saying lots of things about his position on family separation and how it's not his fault and how it's a result of a law that mandates that he separates family. This is a lie. This is patently false. When he talks about this, he's generally talking about two specific things. He's talking about, number one, a 1997 court settlement, and number two, a law called the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act that was last reauthorized in 2013, but actually was originally written back in the Clinton era. So let's talk about the settlement first. The 1997 court settlement is generally referred to as the Flores settlement. It comes from a 1993 Supreme Court case called Flores v. Reno that discussed the government's ability to detain unaccompanied minors for sort of an indefinite period of time. After the lawsuit and after a number of civil lawsuits, the government reached a settlement, which is now called the Flores settlement, that stipulates that unaccompanied minors can only be detained for up to 20 days. The Obama administration pushed this settlement a little bit further to try to say that if the children were detained with their parents, they could stay detained longer than 20 days. Several courts during the Obama administration said that that is a violation of the Flores settlement and that children would still only be allowed to be detained, even with their parents in family detention, for no more than 20 days because of the special needs relating to children. The second thing he's talking about is what's commonly referred to as the TVPRA, which is Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act. Again, the original version of this law was enacted back during the Clinton administration. It was reenacted in 2003, in 2008, and in 2013. This law states that when children arrive at the border, they're supposed to be being assessed for whether or not they're victims of trafficking. And if, in fact, they are victims of trafficking, they're supposed to be separated from the traffickers. Now, the problem is that Trump administration has taken the absurd position that everybody arriving with children is a human trafficker. And so they're taking children away from people who arrive with their parents. And they're prosecuting those parents in federal court for human trafficking and alien smuggling, even though the people that they are bringing over are not the traditional definition of trafficked people, but in fact their own children. This is an absurd interpretation of this law and something that never has been interpreted this way in the past. Even during the George Bush years, who was involved in enacting the policy called Operation Streamline, which was a lot like Trump's zero tolerance policy that ramped up enforcement at the border and charged a lot of people with entering illegally or re-entering illegally. The Bush administration still made an exception for parents who were entering with their children. They did not prosecute them as a policy criminally, and they did not separate the children from the parents. So when the president says that he had no choice but to separate these children, he's lying. He's just straight out lying. Both of the settlement and this law have been around for a very long time, and nobody under the last three presidents has chosen to interpret it in the absurd way that he is interpreting it now. So yesterday what happens is that he comes out and says he's signing an executive order ending family separation, which is the crisis that he himself created and has up until this point said that he has no power to end. So he signs this executive order claiming that it ends the practice of family separation. It actually doesn't. The executive order does not end the zero tolerance policy and require that charges be pressed either for illegal entry or for alien smuggling to these parents that are coming with their children. So while they may not be separated immediately, if they're going to get charged criminally, they will still eventually be separated. Also, the executive order does not address the more than 2,000 children that have already been separated from their parents, which it seems is the administration had no clear plan on what to do with these kids in the first place. Finally, it directs two things. Number one, the building of additional private prisons and military installations to detain families with their children who are not prosecuted criminally indefinitely, in his words, while they process their asylum case. This would seem to go directly against the Flores settlement and the decisions that happened during the Obama administration related to family detention. The executive order also directs the Department of Justice to petition the court to amend the Flores settlement to allow that these children be detained indefinitely with their parents. This is not a win. This is not a good executive order, and it doesn't solve the problem either of the children that have already been taken, children being taken in the future, or the atrocity of family detention. There are many additional lies that he told during his speech, and if you want to see some fact checks related to that, the New York Times, for example, and NPR both did a fact check on that, because we are out of time. This is a huge issue that I'm sure I will be talking about again in the future, but for right now, that's all I have to say on this subject. This is Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Volunteer to canvas or phone bank against Proposition A, right to work, Saturdays from 10 a.m. to whenever. Go to the office at Know on A office at 3600 Broadway, Suite 111. That's right across from the Uptown Theater. Rally to end family separation tomorrow, Friday, June 22nd, 4 to 5:30 p.m. in front of Congressman Kevin Yoder's office. They're trying to hold his feet to the fire. 7325 West 79th Street, Overland Park. Nurses rally also tomorrow for a good contract and protest against HCA. That is from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, June 22nd, in front of Research Hospital at Meyer and Prospect, called by NNU, National Nurses United. Say no to Kobach and his allies Saturday, June 23rd, 2 to 4 p.m. at the Lenexa Community Center, 13420 Oak Street in Lenexa, Kansas. 2018 Kansas City, Kansas Street Blues Festival. See, we have something besides rallies. Saturday, June 23rd, 2 to 11 p.m. at the Lavender Circle L Ranch at 3924 North 49th Drive in Kansas City, Kansas. Rally for Immigration Reform, Sunday, June 24th, 4 to 6 p.m. at the J.C. Nichols Fountain at 47th and Main. Kansans, Know Your Voting Rights Training, June 25th, that's Monday, 6 to 7:30 p.m., Antioch Branch Library, 8700 Shawnee Mission Parkway, Merriam, Kansas, sponsored by the Kansas ACLU. And finally, film screening and discussion of Surveilling Black Lives Matter. This is a film about the surveillance that took place after the Ferguson riots. Saturday, July 14th, from 2 to 5 p.m. at All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, and that is sponsored by the Missouri ACLU. You can find all of this in our calendar, also our archived shows, as well as our upcoming schedule at heartlandlaborforum.org. That's it for tonight's show. Next week, our show is called Our Disappearing Right to Vote, and Is Civil Disobedience Still Relevant? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
Take it in stride. 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.